right. Welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. My great producer, Dan Shugru, is out sick this morning, so we will not be doing the Two for Tuesday. I want to thank Dan Long for sitting in for him. But right now, I want to welcome to the show a great guest. He comes on semi-regularly. His name is Rod Pyle. He's an award-winning author, a journalist. He's a documentary filmmaker, and he is his expertise is in the world of space. He's got a couple of new books out. We're going to talk about that, plus some really big stories in that space world. If you would like to join us, it's 312-981-7200. Let's welcome Rod to the show. Hey, Rod, how are you?
I'm good. It seems like it's been forever since I've talked to you.
Yeah, well, I was off for the holidays the last time you were on the show. Matt Bubala filled in. And I want to talk a little bit about, well, first of all, tell everybody about your background. You're an author, you're a writer, you got into space at the right time because you were born right on the right in the wheelhouse of the space program's popularity.
Yeah, I was born in the late 50s, so I got to see the space program grow up as I did. And I tell you, man, you know, as sensational as what's happening today is, and it really is, as you said, there was some good news that came out just today.
Yeah.
Seeing the Apollo program as a kid was just unbelievable. Every 2 months, these giant rockets thundering off, carrying guys to the surface of the moon, do these incredible missions of exploration, and there was just nothing like it. And the shuttle was spectacular. But it wasn't the same. You know, we weren't leaving Earth orbit. So yeah. we spent 30 years in Earth orbit, and it's time to move on.
Yeah. Well, it's been fascinating to watch. And, boy, we got some. There are some big stories to talk about here, Rod, some major stuff.
Yeah.
But the last time you were on was back in December, and you were in Shanghai with their Science and Technology Museum. You were visiting that. So tell us about how that was. You were only a couple of days into your trip. How'd that go?
It was okay. You know, it was, I grew up in LA, so we're used to smog in the summer when it's hot and cloying. This was smog in the winter so bad you could see it just crossing the streets. Oh. Everybody's wearing surgical masks. They're coughing like crazy. They got a real problem and they know it. And they're actually leaders working on it along with the U.S., but that part is pretty grim. But the museum was cool. I had gone there partly to interface with some people from the space program, and that didn't work out so great because I'm writing this new book about the coming space age, and China's definitely, you know, one to watch because they're moving very fast. Mm. But there's nothing like private enterprise in the U.S. for this right now. I mean, that's just where it's at.
Yeah. Well, so how long were you there in Shanghai?
I was there for about 7 days, and I was down in Suzhou for about 3 days, which is a lovely city that's got canals and stone bridges date back to about 200 BC, I think. So it's a sensational place.
Mm. All right. Now, your two latest books that we'll get to in a little bit, Amazing Stories of the Space Age and Blueprint for a Battlestar. The latest one, Amazing Stories, that was released, what, last month?
Yeah.
A
few weeks ago.
Yeah, we'll talk about that a little bit later on. But I guess the big story here, would you say, Rod, is the is the seven Earth-sized extra planets that have been discovered? Would that be the big story?
That's the big universe story, or the big Earth story is SpaceX. But let's do the seven planets first.
Yeah. So tell us a little bit about what happened. This is a TRAPPIST-1 planets.
Yeah, so we've been looking for exoplanets for a couple of decades, and we've racked up a score of 4,000-something of them. And you can't see them directly. You have to infer them. So there's two basic methods used. One is you look at a star, and if it dims a little teeny bit for the right amount of time, you think there might be a planet going in front of it. And then you have to figure out, well, is this a big planet or a little planet? And how long is it taking? That tells me the orbital period and so forth. So this is why the guys at Caltech and Princeton and places like that make the big bucks, because they can figure these things out. The other way you do it is by seeing if the star moves a little tiny bit sideways, which might indicate that there's a planet going around it, tugging on it. Mm. And these are really minute measurements for very patient people that love math. So TRAPPIST is something they have been looking at for a while. And the name is actually an abbreviation of the telescope that first spotted it, which is the Transiting Planets and Planetesimal Small Telescope.
Wow.
And it's a Belgian operation in Chile. Yeah. And so they got this indication that it looked like there were some exoplanets there. So the Spitzer Space Telescope was turned on it. And Spitzer is one of these big orbiting telescopes that operates in the infrared, and it just will stare at an area for a long time and measure. And as they looked at the stuff coming down there, they said, there's seven of these things. And from the looks of them, and again, they're doing this by inference, But from what they can tell, these are rocky planets. So we've seen lots of big gas balls like Jupiter because they're easier to spot, not because you see them, but because they're so intensely gravitational.
Yeah.
They're yanking stuff around hither and yon, and they make a bigger dimming when they cross a star. So the little rocky planets like Earth and Mars and Venus are harder to spot. But there appear to be seven here, and the big news is that three of them are in what they call the Goldilocks zone. And that's also called the habitable zone. But a friend of mine who works for the Tau Zero Foundation, which I'm involved with, mentioned, you know, be careful when you say habitable zone, because that's leading people to believe that there might not be flares that come out and engulf these planets every now and then with radiation. So you want to say the Goldilocks zone, because that's a place that we could find life and we could find water in the atmosphere and so forth as liquid. So that's the next step, is beginning to look at the spectra from these planets and see what's going on in the atmosphere and if we can spot something that looks like it may be indicative of life processes, or at least the ability to support life.
And, you know, how long before they make an announcement like this? Like, how often do they triple check and double check and quadruple check these movements and these things before they go out and say, okay, we're going to make this announcement there. We've found seven Earth-sized extra planets. How long before they announce it?
Yeah, it depends on the group. I don't remember how long. I know these guys are looking at the data for a couple of years. There was an incident a few years ago with an experiment called BICEP that was one of the first indications they thought of gravity waves, and it turned out to not be quite what they thought, so people have been even more careful since then. So it's like a SETI observation, you know. If you think you've got a radio signal from another star, you're going to make damn sure that you figured out that that's something that's repeatable, and you know what it is before you tell anybody about it. So they looked at it for quite a while.
And so how much longer are they going to be studying this? I mean, do they think that the TRAPPIST zones are going to produce more planets?
There's a chance that it will. I think the bigger question is, you know, since we know there's three in this potentially habitable region of that solar system or that star system, and bear in mind this star is 2,000 times dimmer than our sun. It's a dwarf star. So these planets go around it instead of 365 days like our year. They go around, depending which planet you're talking about, between 1.5 and 12 days. So they're real close. They're moving real fast. But because that star is so much dimmer, some of those are potentially life-supporting. So they're hard to see. So you have to have what's called a coronagraph to get a good look at them, which is an instrument that actually blocks out the pinpoint image of the star and lets you get an idea of what you're seeing around it. Very complicated, hard to do. This is NASA stuff. You can do it on the ground, but it's much tougher because you're looking through all the air. So they'll be studying for a long time. And what they want to see is what the constituents of the atmosphere are, especially if there's methane there, because methane can come from biological processes. It can also come from geological processes. But if you can figure out, you know, you watch it over time, you can begin to get an idea of whether this might be something indicative of life or not. And hey, if we get really lucky and get a radio signal or a laser beam detection or something, then life is sweet and NASA's budget goes up a lot.
There you go. And this is the star that you're talking about is what, 39 light years from here, from Earth?
Yeah, which I was trying to calculate before we got on. I think that's 235 trillion miles, if I'm not mistaken. So it's really far away.
Yeah.
And it's going to take a long time to send something there. But the closest star is just over 4 light years away, and there are a couple of programs underway, notably one called Breakthrough, which is financed by a Russian billionaire. And they're working on ways that they think they can send very small probes to these, at least to that star system, which also has a planet, at least one. And so they'd propel these things with laser beams out there, and they're about the size of a quarter or a half dollar. They're little tiny things, so you just have a whole swarm of them go out there, and they're going to be flying by real fast, so they got to grab their data as quickly as possible and send it home. But the engineering appears to be sound. It's just a question of money, and of course you need one great big whopping laser up in orbit.
Yeah. Okay, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
Rod Pyle is with us. He's a great, great author and a really interesting guy, and he is a journalist, a documentary filmmaker. It's all about space, some big space news, and some new books that Rod has put together, and we'll talk about those as well. But we got a break here, and then the news is next. Hi, everybody. Welcome back. Nick DiGilio here. 720 WGN. Here till 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5. And Steve Cochran at 6. A little bit later on, we're going to talk about phrases that younger people won't understand. Like, hang up the phone. What does that mean to a younger person who never hung up a phone before? We'll get to that. Well, also, I wasn't here yesterday to recap the immediacy of the Oscars, so we'll talk a little bit more about that and some of the highlights, including the last 5 minutes of the show, which was pretty unbelievable. We'll get to that a little bit later on, but right now, Rod Pyle is with us. He's an award-winning author. He's a journalist. He knows everything about space. His latest books are Amazing Stories of the Space Age and Blueprint for a Battlestar. You can check out pylebooks.com for more information. We have a link on our Facebook page. And we welcome Rod back to the show. Rod, welcome back, sir.
Thank you, sir.
All right. So let's talk a little bit about what's the other big story that you're very, very excited about.
Yeah.
And this is a big one, is the SpaceX to fly a private to paying citizens around the moon next year. Is that the plan?
That's the plan. And, you know, it would have been a stunner to me had they just said we're going to fly a couple of NASA guys around the moon. But NASA's already talking about doing that with their big SLS mega booster that they're working on and their Orion. So here comes SpaceX saying, hey, you know what? We're going to do that, too. And we're scheduled to do it before you do.
Yeah.
So that was kind of a, I was actually, if I could just set this up for a second, I'm working on a writing project up at JPL where I work occasionally. And I'm sitting there with these two, you know, they're NASA guys, they're space scientists. We're in the middle of this meeting about one of the projects they're working on. And I'm struggling to understand what they're talking about. And I see this pop up on my phone and I'm thinking, this can't be right. So I pull up the story and there's this long pause, and I realize they're both staring at me. And I said, Elon Musk just said he's sending his Dragon 2 to the moon. And they went, huh? So it kind of broke up the meeting for a little while.
Yeah, I bet.
That was, you know, that was a great second space age moment there. So, yeah, so he announced today. He's been working, as you know, the story begins in 2002. This multimillionaire billionaire says, I'm going to start a rocket company and I'm going to fly your payloads up in orbit cheaper than anybody else. They said, that's nice, kid, move along. And it took him a while. You know, he had a number of failures. He didn't have a successful flight until the late 2000s. But since then, he's picked up a ton of steam. He got a huge amount of investment in 2008 from private parties. Then NASA started signing contracts with him to fly payload up to the space station. And he's been doing that ever since. They haven't flown people yet. And they've had a couple of failures with their big Falcon 9 rocket. So, you know, it puts some people's teeth on edge a little bit. But that's just part of the teething pains when you're pushing the envelope and working on all this new technology. So this announcement came as a bit of a surprise. We knew he was planning in the next year, year and a half to fly a crew to the space station because he's got a deal with NASA to do that. And that's what they've been working towards. But this journey out to the moon came as a real shock to most of us. So that was great.
Now, he's got two people in mind already, and Elon Musk has said that it's a private mission to paying customers, and but he says that the two individuals know each other. Now, is there some sort of like team trying to find out who these two people are?
Oh yeah, you bet.
Yeah.
I don't know, and I was told that they weren't Hollywood people because James Cameron came to mind instantly because
yeah,
the kind of thing he'd do.
Yeah,
and he'd shoot the whole thing, right? He'd have his
yeah,
face pop in the frame saying, "Here I am. Yeah. That's the moon behind me. I'm going around the moon. I'm going around the moon. You're never gonna be able to do it, but I did. Look at me."
Yeah, it'll be in 3D too. So,
but he makes great movies. You know, we can't take that away from him. So apparently, it's not a Hollywood pair. And what stunned me was they're going by themselves, so they'll be trained, but these aren't test pilot astronauts that have thousands of hours in jets and then train for 5 years for a mission. These are a couple of folks that are going to train for a year and a half and then hop in this thing and be sent. And just to be clear, this is a loop the moon mission, so it's going to leave Earth orbit, fly past the moon, go out to about 400,000 miles, and then the moon's gravity brings it back. It slingshots past the moon and then comes back to Earth. So while it's still very exacting and complicated, it's a lot simpler and a lot safer than what Apollo 8 did, which was the very first spacecraft that went out there in 1968,
yeah,
which was fire a rocket to break into lunar orbit and then sit there for a day. You know, that was pretty hairy.
So, and what are, in general, what are the thoughts on Elon Musk? in general? Like the guys, the NASA guys, the guys you hang out with, people are pretty pro on this guy?
Yeah, I mean, everybody admires him a lot, I think. I mean, I'm sure there are critics, but generally the sense is this guy's brilliant. We admire what he's doing. We really admire his commitment to put up his own money, because for 50 years, the U.S. government's been paying these cost-plus contracts to the major aerospace contractors. We'll give you all this money to accomplish what we're asking you to do, and if there's money left over, we'll work that out later, and they get fat and happy on it. Musk invested $100 plus million of his own money in this entire venture so far, and has only spent about $1 billion to get where he is, which it's a lot of money. But when you compare that to what it costs to do things the way NASA generally does business, it's a steal. You know, it's a tenth, I think, of what they've spent so far just on the Orion capsule. So there's a lot of respect for him. I think the one hiccup was last September. I think we talked about this. He announced his big Mars plans. He's got to build this big, super-duper, huge, multiple bus-sized capsule and put it on top of a huge rocket that makes the Saturn V look like a toothpick and launch it out to Mars with 70 people on it and build a city. And, you know, it'll go back and forth every couple of months. And there'll be fleets of them and all this stuff. That's a stretch for a lot of folks. Again, the engineering works. It's just a question of the money and just the chutzpah it takes to make all that happen. But this announcement today is much more achievable. And it is worth noting, this came on the heels of them nudging. They were going to send one of his Dragon capsules up to Mars unmanned or uncrewed with some NASA experiments on it. That got pushed to 2020 instead of 2018. You can only do this every 2 years economically. So this apparently was kind of what dropped into that slot in their timeline.
Hmm. Now, on the other side here is NASA, and Trump is pushing for a first-term moon mission. Is this correct?
Yeah, there's actually a lot happening there. The transition team he brought in is very pro-moon and very pro-private enterprise and very pro-privatization. So here's NASA coming out of the Obama years with their canceled Constellation Moon program. Then the shuttle got shut down. So they started taking their human spaceflight money that they weren't spending on the space station, saying, okay, we're going to build this great big mega rocket that's ultimately going to be bigger than the Saturn V. And the Orion capsule. So they've been sort of chugging away at that for many, many years now, 7-8 years in this iteration, because it was part of what was happening with the Constellation before. But the question has been, what are you going to do with it once it's done? It's so expensive at $1 billion plus per flight. They were trying to figure out, okay, do we go do this asteroid mission that they've been talking about? Do we go to the moon? Do we just work on the Mars idea and go to cislunar space, which is the space around the moon but not land, and maybe help other people land? What should we do? So the Trump people came in and said, well, the moon is clearly, and I'm paraphrasing greatly, but the moon is clearly the place to go to work out what we need to make this big, long year-plus Mars journey out and back. So we really need to be looking at that. So they've done one test flight on a smaller rocket with the Orion capsule. They have another one that was scheduled for 2018 that was supposed to go up on the big Space Launch System rocket. Now, last week, the acting administrator of NASA came out and said, we're going to look at putting people on that rocket and looping them around the moon, because that would be a very useful a way to really utilize that flight and make it cost effective and do something exciting and thrilling and inspiring. And then a week later, Elon Musk says, I'm doing the same thing, and I'm doing it sooner. So it's kind of an odd state of affairs. From what I've been able to tell, NASA was briefed on what Musk was planning to announce. So apparently this isn't really viewed as a competition, but it's hard not to look at it stealing a little bit of NASA's thunder.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Okay, we got some phone calls coming in. If you guys have any questions or comments about the space world, 312-981-7200, 312-981-7200. Rod Pyle is my guest, and we're going to talk about a couple of his newest books, too, and much more. And we've got Carrie on the line. Hey, Carrie.
Hey, morning, Nick.
Hey.
Hey, question for Rod. Fascinating stuff. About a year and a half ago, there was a report of one of these Goldilocks planets, and that's what sparked some plans that people like even Stephen Hawking weighed in and out about building a giant light so that people, other planets can't see us. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yeah, there's some concern. The bigger picture in Hawking's mind anyway, and a few others, is you know, before we go around trying to make contact with other civilizations, let's make sure they're going to like us and they're not going to come down here and make us into lunch. So there's been a couple of plans. And, you know, all these things are enormous logistical and engineering exercises. So you've got to really, you know, it's hard enough to get people to agree on, you know, what we're going to do about climate change and carbon dioxide, much less building some massive shield in orbit or something. So I don't see that happening, but I think, you know, there is a wisdom to stop and to consider. If we're going to talk to these people, let's make sure we don't piss them off in the process. We've seen enough movies. In fact, Nick and I have a movie that we love together. You know where I'm going with this, don't you?
Yeah. I think so.
You hate that movie, Independence Day.
Yeah, I
do. You don't want to piss off the aliens. They do bad things.
Yeah.
So
I thought you were saying Galaxy Quest, but okay.
Yeah. I liked you said Galaxy Quest, right?
Yeah.
Yep.
That's a good movie. That's a good movie.
That was so right on the money without saying the words Star Trek.
Right.
So right on the money. It was unbelievable.
Yeah. All right. Yeah. Kerry, thanks for the call, man.
Thanks, Kerry.
Take care. All right. You know, speaking of movies, before we break here, Rod, a couple of films since we haven't talked in a while. What did you think of Arrival?
I haven't seen it.
Oh, okay.
And I haven't written about it. I did write a piece about Passengers, and I had a wonderful interview with the production designer that was great fun. I think that was one of the topics that came up when I was on, but you were out.
Yeah.
And brilliant guy. I don't think the movie did terribly well. I just saw clips, but the whole idea behind the spaceship was fun. This kind of cruise ship sort of environment.
Right. Well, let me know when you see Arrival, because I thought it was a terrific film.
Yeah, I've heard it was absolutely the best thing since Contact, and sort of in that vein.
It is in that vein. Now, Hidden Figures. What do you think of Hidden Figures?
Same story.
Oh, you haven't seen it?
Well, here's the problem. I'm working on this book that's 70,000 words, and I'm, you know, two-thirds of the way there, but it's due in a month, and I'm just tearing my hair out.
I got you. All right.
Yeah, I've kind of been locked. I'm just ashamed, because everybody I know has seen it. They loved it. It was an Oscar favorite.
Yeah.
And
it's a terrific, you know, Rod, you'll love it. I'm telling you, you're going to love it. It is a really, really terrific film.
And by the way, I'll add that the folks I know that count the rivets on the rudder of the airplanes of the World War II movies saw that and said, you know, the slide rules were right, the hairstyles were right, the hemlines were right. Everything was damn near perfect.
Yeah.
So it really scored high with that crowd.
Yeah, it felt that way too, watching it. It really did. All right, Rod, hang on, okay?
You bet.
All right, Rod Pyle is with us, and we're going to come back and talk about a couple of his books, and also the space poop problem, which is a very important problem. We'll talk about that right after we take this break on 720 WGN. Yeah. All right, welcome back, everybody. Nick DiGilio here on 720 WGN. We're live in the Allstate Studio, 7th floor of the Trib Tower, here until 5 a.m. Steve Grzanich with the opening bell at 5, and the great Steve Cochran at 6 for your morning drive. We're not doing 2 for Tuesday this morning. My friend Dan Chagrou is out sick this morning, and hopefully he'll be back tomorrow. And we'll get to our Wildcard Wednesday feature tomorrow. Also coming up, we're going to be talking about phrases that younger people just won't understand anymore. And I'll recap some of the Oscar stuff since I was off yesterday. And I also have an article about where some of the actors and actresses keep their Oscars or have lost them. We'll talk about that as well. Rod Pyle is with me, though. He's a great guy, an award-winning journalist, and an author. His latest books are Amazing Stories of the Space Age and Blueprint for a Battlestar. And we welcome him back to the show. Rod, welcome back.
Thank you.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about your latest book, Amazing Stories of the Space Age. Tell everybody about it.
Well, this was something I've been writing books for about 10 years, 12 years now, and this is my ninth book. And I'd been collecting odd stories as I found them as I was going along. So everybody who's interested in this stuff knows about Apollo, knows about the shuttle, knows about Voyager and Curiosity and so forth. But there's a lot of missions that were planned that didn't fly from World War II forward, especially during the paranoia between, say, 1950 and the end of the 1960s. like the Army planning to put a base on the moon, or the Air Force also plan to put a base on the moon, or the Germans trying to build a rocket plane to bomb New York, ideas about Mars bases, atomic rockets, these kinds of things. So I collected these for a number of years, and I was actually pitching them as a TV show, the History Channel. We got very close, but didn't happen. I thought, you know, if I do it as a TV show, it's going to be the Time Life version of these things. Short, sweet, to the point, a few visual effects. But as a book, you can really dig in there and kind of roll around in it and weave a fun story. So that's how it started. And it was just an absolute blast to do, because the more you dig, the wilder these stories become. And a lot of this stuff has only been declassified in the last 2 or 3 years. So that made it a perfect time.
Do you have a couple of favorite stories that are included?
Yeah, one is Project Orion, and this is something that started there were people coming up with the idea of an atomic rocket in the 50s. 1958-59, General Atomics, which was a major defense contractor in the U.S., got interested in this and did a self-funded study for a while before the military and NASA came in and started giving them some money. But the idea was, there had been various designs for atomic engines. One was actually tested, but this used atomic bombs. So it looks like an enormous 50 caliber bullet. When I say enormous, the plans ranged anywhere from 10,000 to a million tons.
Jeez.
And, you know, 100 feet plus in diameter. And so they would just feed atomic bombs out the back. And as they exploded, there's a big pressure plate, a pusher plate, and shock absorbers behind it. As these bombs exploded, it would propel the rocket. Again, it's one of these things where the engineering, it's been studied off and on continuously since that time, never built. But it's been studied to death, and it apparently would work. And we're talking about, you know, opening up the solar system. You could get to Mars in a matter of weeks instead of 4 to 6 months. The problem was, their plan was to launch it from the ground, and you can imagine that created a little consternation in people's minds,
yeah,
having 1,000 nuclear explosions between liftoff and orbit.
Yeah.
There was a smaller version of it studied later on in the late 60s for NASA to launch on a Saturn V, but when the Apollo program wound down, most of those kind of missions went away with it. But it would have been sensational. Freeman Dyson, famous physicist, was part of it. And his motto was Mars by 1965, Saturn by 1970. And he meant it. He wasn't being tongue-in-cheek. So, you know, maybe one of these days we'll have something like that. It would be a really, really wonderful way to get around the solar system in a hurry.
Yeah, wow. All right, that's just one of the amazing stories of the space age. And Blueprint for a Battlestar. I love this book, Rod. I got to tell you. Tell everybody about it.
Great. This was a science of sci-fi book, and the idea was, if you want to build a Battlestar, what does it take? What's happening with flying cars? Can you really build a lightsaber? Are wormholes ways you can travel around space? You know, what's the current state of the art in AI, and where do we think that's heading? So it's a series of fairly short chapters with a lot of illustrations, just kind of going through where these ideas came from, what the state of the art is today, and what we think might happen in the next 10 to 15 years. We had to put a cap on it somewhere, because otherwise you start talking about things like teleportation that may or may not ever happen. But as far as anybody could tell now, it would take something like 100,000 years to actually teleport something of any size anywhere, because you got to break it down and put it back together.
Right.
Then you get into, do people have souls, and do those travel, and all that kind of stuff. So that one hit the dustbin, but the other 25 chapters stayed in there, and it was a lot of fun to do. It's a really neat book.
Yeah, it is. It's very, very cool. And you can check out pilebooks.com for more information and all of that stuff. And now we want to get to the space poop problem. I didn't realize that NASA had the Space Poop Challenge, and it was a Space Poop Challenge project, and there was a winner announced just recently to get this problem fixed?
Yeah, this is a crowdsourcing thing. So NASA began to notice how much intelligence was out there. They normally would hire people or engineering firms to study these things, but they said, you know, it is such a bargain to use crowdsourcing. So they set it up as a crowdsourcing challenge through a website called HeroX, which is part of the whole XPRIZE endeavor. And they called it the Space Poop Challenge. The technical name was a fecal urine and menstrual management system, otherwise known as a FUMS, which is not the best acronym.
No.
Prizes up to $30,000. And this Air Force doctor named Thatcher Carden won it against 5,000 other entries. And the challenge was, you know, sometimes if you're in the space station and something's coming that might impact it, we're worried about getting it out of the way in time. We got to rush the crew into a Soyuz capsule and they got to sit there. So if they got to sit there for a long time and the period they set was 144 hours or 6 days, that's too long to do what they normally do, which is sit in diapers because you can get rashes and infections and all kinds of stuff. So they said, how do we get the things they need to get out of their bodies, out of their suits out? So this guy came up with basically what looks like a drop seat, except it's in the groin area instead of on the back. You remember in your onesies when you were a kid with the bunny ears and all that. And various implements that go up inside the body and take care of business. The most interesting of which, if I could put it delicately, is a wand that is inserted in the perineum, and it's got, it's a tube, so it takes out what it needs to take out, and it's got this endless loop of basically moistened toilet paper that you kind of crank through it and cleans you up, and out it goes, and you're good for another, if you keep your diet right, maybe another 20 hours before you have to do it again. And believe me, astronauts know how to eat low-residue diets when they're in these situations.
Yeah, I bet.
Because they don't want to do it either.
Wow. And the guy's name is Thatcher Carden.
Thatcher Carden. How's that for a name?
That is a hell of a name. And he ended up winning. And he is a physician, a family physician, Air Force officer, and a flight surgeon.
Yeah, the thing that really sort of tickled me about it was he said, you know, I wanted to put this together, and the first prize was $20,000 with a couple of smaller ones. And he said he built his prototype by buying things at hardware stores, thrift shops, and the 99-cent store, which is wherever, that's where I always go when I want to prototype something for NASA. So there you go. You know, the 99-cent store works for all of us.
That's great. Listen, Rod, always a pleasure talking to you, man. It's just, it's always great. And you can check out Pyle Books, P-Y-L-E, pylebooks.com for more information. The latest book is Amazing Stories of the Space Age. Rod, always fascinating and always a pleasure.
Great pleasure, and before I see you next time, I'll see all those movies and whatever else is out then so we can actually talk about that
stuff. Okay, great. Thanks, Rod.
Take care.
You too. There you go. Rod Pyle, everybody. Check out pylebooks.com for more info.